right, we're going to get started with our program here today. I am Teresa Broderick. I'm the Cornet Chicago Program Committee Chair, and we put these lunches on each month. So thank you so much for coming. Our topic this month, like most Aprils, is around sustainability and ESG. So we have two really good speakers here today. I'll introduce them both. We're going to have one come up and talk, and then the other come up, and then we'll do a combined Q&A at the end. All right, so our first speaker is Jess Ballhofer. She has spent the last 20 years focused on the intersection of sustainability, real estate, and business. She is currently the Global Sustainability and Carbon and Energy Lead for RUES, the real estate group at Google. She's primarily leading the Net Zero 2030 strategy for Google's real estate, transportation, and food. And prior to Google, she led sustainability consultancies, JPB Strategies, and co-led the sustainability consulting practice at Jones Lang LaSalle. Additionally, Jess is currently an adjunct professor at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering. She has a master's degree in sustainability management from Columbia University and an undergraduate degree in architecture from the University of Pennsylvania. All right. Our second speaker today is Karen McClellan, who's the Director of Real Estate for Schneider Electric North America. She's been with Schneider Electric for 27 years and led the real estate group for 20 years. Her vision is to enhance the workplace, acknowledging changes in the way we work with an increased attention on sustainability and inclusion. Schneider Electric aspires to be at the forefront as a digital and sustainable company, reflecting their net zero commitments. And beyond serving the strategy, Schneider Electric workplaces showcase the potential of their products for a greener future. So with that, we will have Jess come on up.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's such a pleasure to be here. I can't wait to talk about one of my favorite topics, ESG. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time. I'll give a little bit of an update, go into an agenda in a moment, and then we'll do some wonderful opportunity to have some more speakers, and then we'll come up and do a moderation. So today, we are going to talk a little bit about, first, I'll introduce myself, and then talk a little bit about what ESG is, and then we'll go into a little bit about why ESG is important, because I think that's a really important element and angle to be able to talk through what this means for corporate real estate. And then I'll talk a little bit about sustainability at Google more generally, and I'll focus a bit on something called carbon-free energy and then a sustainable workplaces, so what this means from a real estate lens. And then I'll talk a little bit about a project just to sort of put it all together. So my name is Jessica. I live in Winnetka, lived in Chicago for about 12 years before I sold out and moved to the burbs. And I have two kids, and we spend a lot of time at sporting stuff because they're into sports. And so I'm going to first start a little bit about what ESG is. And I'm going to ask a quick question. Has everybody heard of the term ESG before? Generally, yes. I feel like even 3 years ago, the answer would have been no. So I feel like we're making a lot of progress. And sometimes it's because it's in the news, which is actually even more interesting. And so ESG specifically, this is actually a little bit hard to read, but I wanted to just take a moment and really ground on what ESG is. And it's really a framework that helps identify initiatives and commitments, but also risk. This is a really big conversation about risk. And so environmental area is really about the impact on the planet. So this is everything like greenhouse gases, energy consumption, natural resources, deforestation, things that are really in like we call the E, the environmental section, real planet focused. The social is what's called sort of impact on employees and communities. And this also is a lot like risk mitigation around like safety, employees, retention, and actually the supply chain, which I know a lot of organizations that are here today are actually also in supply chains of other organizations. And the third area is called governance, which is really about like making sure that the E and the S are doing what they're supposed to do and making sure organizations really have like risk management processes to ensure that they're thinking about the E and the S. So Also very light and hard to see here. I actually started to throw up the groups at Google that are actually in each one of these sections. So in the environmental section, a lot of our sustainability groups live there, as well as our environmental health and services sections. In the social, that's where you have supply chain teams, and then our diversity and inclusion groups. And then in governance, this is where we have huge teams that are focused on reporting, because this is like everyone's favorite topic as of late, and also data. So this is where a lot of it's sort of like measuring the work that happens in ENS. And so what I put up here is quick sort of thinking about things like health and performance. That's really like an ENS conversation. Sourcing goes across all three, regulatory requirements the same, and then data and reporting, again, happens across all of the areas. So why is ESG important? I could spend 25 minutes just talking about this in general. But really, a big part and the most predominant now is about managing risk. And so this is a really big conversation about long-term value, mandatory disclosing requirements. And disclosing is different than reduction in some ways, right? You can measure something, but not necessarily have to reduce against it. And so both are actually very prevalent right now. The first is reporting, like actually measuring what your consumption is. And increasing regulatory focus is actually a nod to the reduction. So you'll see things in the EMEA area, as well as things across the United States, where there's a lot more requirements, not just to benchmark and measure, but also to show reduction. But also important on the ESG lens is customer loyalty and brand reputation. So this is if you have a client that's really interested in sustainability, you might have a sustainability section up at the front, right, because they're really interested in that. But also employee attraction and retention, innovation and opportunity, which is a really huge opportunity, and then generally social and environmental impact. I love to put this slide up, another one that I could spend some time on. But really, the really important part of ESG right now is the pressure that's coming from everywhere. So this is everything, again, from regulatory pressures, so things that are happening regionally, things that are happening globally from governments, but also a huge pressure coming from the private sector. And so as you start to see more about this, there's some stuff in the news that's not always positive about like the term ESG, but you will see over years, even if we call it something different, ESG is not going away. It's really about measuring the risk mitigation for an organization and making sure you sort of put yourself in the right spotlight. And there's just tons of articles that talk through the reason why this is important and how it's moving forward. Another eye chart that's really not intended to go into deep, but we actually did this study in our real estate team for Google to sort of start mapping out what are the regulations that we see forthcoming so that we can start to prepare for how we adapt to it. And this is actually a quick map that just shows we got a lot of offices and we got a lot of risk. So it's an opportunity for us to make sure that we're thinking about measuring and also reduction across a number of different areas. Okay, I'm gonna now spend a little bit of time and talk a little bit about sustainability at Google. So Google, big company, we have a lot of areas around sustainability, and we really try to think about building sustainability into everything we do, so embedding it into a lot of different parts of the organization. So in our strategy, we have a full focus on data centers. Important note, I do not work on data centers. I work on the real estate outside of the data centers. We have carbon-free energy, which is across data centers and other parts of the organization. And I'll talk a little bit more about that soon. Sustainable workplaces, devices and services, and technology. And again, we could spend a lot more time up here, but today I'm gonna focus specifically on carbon-free energy and then sustainable workplaces. And there's a reason why we keep these slightly separate, and I'll talk through what that is. So carbon-free energy. So Google has spent really our entire history focused on climate action. And part of that is because we wanted to make sure that, like from a resiliency perspective, we actually had the energy to power our buildings and our data centers from the offset. And so in 2007, we became the first major company to be carbon neutral for our operations. That basically meant that we purchased what are called renewable energy offsets, so offsets for our use. In 2017, we reached 17 years of carbon neutrality, which basically meant that we were actually procuring alternative energy to match our whole portfolio. But the really important thing about that is it didn't necessarily happen in every grid that we operate in. So we have data centers and we have offices all around the world. And we were basically just making sure that we matched alternative energy to our offices, but it was like a one-for-one on the whole portfolio. The really big change came out in 2020, which is actually one of the most important moments for Google in our sustainability and carbon-free energy space. And it's something called 24/7 carbon-free energy. And the reason why this is important is essentially we've mapped for every grid, which is like the place that you actually procure, you get your scope to, which is your purchased electricity. We are matching every grid 100% hour by hour for our offices and our data centers, which basically is trying to get more local. So the more, the sort of the farther we progress on our journey, the more local we're trying to be in order to ensure that we're actually matching our needs with what's available. And there's a lot of graphs that I could show that sort of talk through this, but this is a helpful one. Oh, we can't see the, there's a map behind this. You can't see it. Basically what this is showing is every single hour of the day. And if you have heard like demand, that word demand, we're really just trying to match the needs of our facilities with procurement, with like energy at the exact same time. And the reason why that's important is because the sun is shining at certain hours, right? But actually you need energy at different parts of the day. And so we're trying to actually use a combination of things like wind and solar and battery storage and other technologies to sort of couple together so that we're really ensuring that we're like trying to offset at a specific location. So for any energy nerds in the room, this is, people get really excited and want to talk about this a lot. Okay, so now I'm going to take a step back and talk a little bit about real estate and workplace services. So the first part was really energy. And the reason we separate the energy piece, and there's actually an entire team that's focused on this, is because it's really important to focus early in the journey on the energy piece and ensure that we're actually procuring early in the journey. And so we're doing that across, again, our data centers as well as our offices, but we're also doing that for our procurement. So we're partnering with actually suppliers to help ensure that they also have alternative energy generation and we can help them on their journey as well. So real estate and workplace services. Before I jump to this slide, I'm actually going to go here. So we talked a little about sustainability generally. Google's a really big company. And where real estate actually lives is focused specifically on supporting the organization. So we actually live underneath the CFO organization. So we have a lot of focus on our costs because we're a cost center. And we really support Googlers. So we have about 800 offices, which is about 190,000 Googlers, 60 countries, 200 cities, 360 cafes, and 350 buses. So we have a really big portfolio, and it's, again, buildings, food, and transportation. And it's everything that supports the Googler itself, not necessarily the data centers, again, which is really focused on our energy consumption. And so the really important thing about Google and about RUs versus data centers is that it's very nuanced. We have, again, if we're in 60 countries, every single country has a different regulatory environment, different needs. The sites can be everywhere from a Thompson Center to a one-floor fit-out inside a landlord building. And so we really have a huge variety of different types of real estate within our portfolio. So the three areas that we talk about in RUs from a sustainability perspective are first, accelerating carbon-free, which I talked a little bit about before, but actually goes deeper, not just in energy procurement, but also things like efficiency. Advancing circular systems, so the word circularity, sometimes a, like a waste conversation, but has a lot to do with like reuse in our spaces, everything from furniture to food, and then cultivating healthy spaces and places. And we have a really, really incredible ecology program that actually lives in the third one. And so we spend quite a bit of time on sort of that regeneration side within our offices and our spaces. Okay, so within RUS, we have, like, our focus is carbon-free, circularity, and healthy spaces. We also sort of tie up to these Google public commitments. And the public commitments are in carbon, we have a 24/7 carbon-free energy, which we talked about before, but then also a net zero goal. So we spend a lot of time in between those two. Water replenishment goal, so to make sure that we are minimizing what we need on our campuses and replenishing it at 120% of the water that we use and consume. And then we have a number of waste goals specific to the circular economy and things like food waste and plastics. And so I'll spend a little bit of time and just talk about like RUS generally and some of our principles, and then I'll talk about some of the details of our individual programs. So rather than providing a blanket solution across the portfolio, because I mentioned how many countries and locations that we're in, RUS really spends time on each individual project at the project level and tries to think about things that are important at the local scale. So for example, a place like India, we spend a lot of time talking about water. If we're talking about California, we talk a lot about solar and the opportunity to actually procure in that market. This left picture is something called Dragon Scale, which we installed and designed actually at Bayview, which is a really important location for us in California. And we designed a new solar type and system that can actually help capture solar at every time of the day. So we're working a lot on things that are really local and important for the region. Another example of this is actually a monarch butterfly pledge that we have across the West Coast that is 100% focused on a migratory pattern within that area. And so I'll talk a little bit about energy and carbon, but really this is a combination of making sure that we are reducing our energy as much as possible, and then matching that energy reduction with carbon-free energy in every market that we're in. But we also spend quite a bit of time thinking about things like refrigerants, new refrigerants, reducing refrigerant leak rates, and also things like renewable diesel. So there's a lot of different things if you actually double-click in the energy and carbon space. Also energy efficiency, which I mentioned. So we spend quite a bit of time actually on our food program because we feed Googlers breakfast and lunch every day. And that's actually a really, really big footprint for us. So everything from the procurement, so like what we buy for food, to the actual operation of those kitchens. Then circularity. So we know the stuff we consume, where it ends up, and how to actually start focusing on that circularity lens so that we can minimize our footprint as much as possible. Food and food waste, between providing great food to Googlers, we really focus a lot of our efforts on sorting our waste and also partnering with a lot of innovative companies to do sort of new technology around food waste in general, both on site and off. And then ecology and biodiversity. And so a lot of our areas, especially places like California, where there is an incredible opportunity to actually focus on things like flood and stormwater, we actually have spent quite a bit of focus on the biodiversity lens of our ecosystem, and providing a lot of habitats for wildlife. And New York, actually, we just opened up something called St. John's Terminal. It opened, I think, maybe a month ago, and we have an incredible program on biodiversity, and we actually planted the native grasses a year and a half before they opened so that they had the opportunity to actually develop by the time we actually brought Googlers in. That's a whole program we could spend quite a bit of time talking on. Okay, so now I'm going to spend just a couple minutes talking about what this looks like in an actual, like, real-life situation. So we are actually in the process of building King's Cross in London. And what's very different about this, so this actually is planning on opening up this year. This has not yet opened up. And this is a mixed-use facility, which has been a real focus for Google. So making sure we're not just building offices, but we're building offices in a way that integrates into the community as well. But we actually spend a lot of time on our reuse at Google. So we try to think things like the Thompson Center, or I was talking to somebody earlier about an example in California where we took, I think it was a 300-year-old hangar, not 300, probably, don't quote me, that goes back to the recording. I should get that number right. Probably like about a 100-year-old hangar, and actually turned it into a beautiful office. And so it's the opportunity to think about our real estate in a different way, and also engage really, really strongly with the community. So I'll give a couple slides, talk about some cool stuff that's happening specifically at this office space in London. And again, this is an example of a place where in London there are a lot of regulatory requirements around sustainability. So there's a huge interest in us being able to partner with the city itself and be able to come back to our environmental report and talk about the work that was happening, again, in the EMEA region. So sustainable infrastructure. So again, we are focused on our 24/7 carbon-free energy goal. So we have procured alternative energy specific to the growth that we anticipate at this site. All of our kitchens on site will be all electric. This has been a really important focus for us, and spending quite a bit of time with our chefs to actually engage and teach them about what it looks like to actually cook with all electric versus gas. Been really interesting. And we are also doing quite a bit to actually track our energy efficiency at a very sort of local scale. So metering has been a really important program for us. And then we also have something called BOSS, which essentially is the opportunity to have a very like granular insight into the building systems. So not just about metering, but really understanding how all of our systems work together and the opportunity to actually get a lot of data from our buildings. Embodied carbon. One of my favorite topics that I could, again, spend 20 minutes on. This is a scope 3, which means it's part of our value chain. Embodied carbon basically is the materials that are used to actually construct a building. So when you think about energy as the operation, the embodied carbon is the carbon that it takes to actually to make all of the materials and for the materials to get put into the building itself. So they say that there's over a lifespan of a building, about 20% is the actual carbon of operating it, and 80% is the carbon for constructing it in the first place. So that's one of the reasons why we focus quite a bit on that circularity piece and using adaptive sites like the Thompson Center instead of starting from scratch. So this was actually a newer construction building, but we focused a lot on what we could do during the construction to actually eliminate and minimize our carbon footprint. And so we ended up with a 15% reduction for the base building. And that was actually everything from more sustainable concrete and steel to actually some of the finishes that went into the existing space. Sustainable materials, one of the ways that we also drove down our embodied carbon was something called cross-laminated timber. This is actually happening quite a bit also in the West Coast area, and it allows us to use quite a bit less concrete specifically, and it is also beautiful, so you don't have to finish it in the ways that you do other spaces. So it's a renewable resource. It requires less heat and energy to produce itself, and it's called mass timber. It's a mass timber product that allows you to span larger areas, but it's still actually made of wood. And then ecology and biodiversity, I'll talk a little bit about this. This is going to be a crown jewel of the space. It's actually our rooftop garden that includes 133 different types of plant species. So really opportunity to create a microcosm within the city of London. So really great opportunity that we actually had an incredible partnership and took quite a bit of time with the borough of Camden, which is an area of London, and the London Wildlife Trust. So that's it. I look forward to hearing a little bit more from Karen about Schneider, and looking forward to answering any questions that you might have afterwards. Thanks so much.
Okay. Just a reminder, Karen McClellan with Schneider Electric. Thanks, Jess. That was wonderful. Loved hearing all that about Google. I'm going to take a slightly different approach in terms of what we're doing at Schneider Electric and really drill down into specifically what it means, and I know this is personable, but what does it mean for me and my job, and how do I have to do it? She talked about, you know, these are the big goals for the company. This is what we need to do. Schneider has very similar goals. We partner a lot with Google. We're friends. We work together. But I took a different approach, and I wanted to say, you know, I consider myself boots on the ground. What does it mean? What do we have to do? So I'm going to start out just tell you, sometimes I say Schneider is one of the biggest companies that nobody knows anything about, right? So, and in our mission statement, again, similar to Google, you know, our mission is to be your digital partner for sustainability and efficiency. So it's right there in our mission statement. We got to be sustainable. We want to take that to our customers. So we also need to make sure we're doing it in the back of the house. A little bit about our business, you know, close to $36 billion in revenue, North America. And again, I'm focusing because I'm here in North America. That's what I'm responsible for. We're going to talk about North America. That's a big part of the revenue. And then employees, 168,000. I like Googlers. I don't have Googlers, but we have employees, which quite a few are here in North America. Specific, and I figured, again, we're all here. What are we talking about? What is the footprint here in North America? Specifically for us that we're managing in North America is 223 sites around 13 million square feet. So that's kind of generally what my responsibility, my team's responsibility is. And again, just one more pitch slide for Schneider and what we do and kind of the markets that we play in and where we're at in these markets. You know, electrification, automation, and digitization. Ooh, complicated words there. But we're at the top. We're leaders in a lot of these industries and where we're playing in those markets, buildings, data centers, infrastructure, industry. So you'll see us, again, you probably don't even realize it. We're there a lot. We're there a lot behind the scenes, and we're kind of a big player in the sustainability market. So I kind of wanted to back up and take a look at this, you know, like, where did my goals come from? Where did this all come from? And I'm sure you've all have seen this graphic, but I just kind of needed to show, because I did the research myself, and I was like, where do my company goals, where did this happen? Well, this is the you know, 2015 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And I was like, I did, you know, a little bit, I'm like, I'm just, you know, I'm being a good soldier doing what I'm doing, but where did this all come from? So I just think it's really interesting that this is what is driving us all. This is the common goal from these United Nations goals from 2015 with the aim to be achieved by 2030. And I love the, you know, it's the blueprint to achieve a better and more sustainable future for all. Love that that's where that came from. So, and again, above my pay level, but this is where Schneider said, hey, how do we take those and how do we interpret those 17 goals? Well, they turned into 6 long-term commitments, which again, I appreciate. I'm like, got to drill it down for me. Give me a little bit more specific. What do I need to do at my level? Okay, so I've got these 6 long-term commitments. We've got these very specific targets for each one of these. Again, my job, what I'm doing, I'm going to drill down into climate. So on the climate, okay, Act for Climate in a Positive World. And there you can see these are the United Nations goals that are very specific towards the climate goal. Drilling down even farther, okay, climate action. Okay, we're getting a little bit farther. Okay, exactly, what do I need to do? So this is the net zero roadmap that we developed. Again, across all scopes, I'm not so much worried about the others, the suppliers, the customers. I'm focused on the operations. That's exactly what I need to drill down to do. So I'm gonna take that drill down. And so that little box there in the middle, that's that net zero ready. Okay. So I need to take from all those goals, I got to be net zero ready. What exactly does that mean? How do I get there? So you can see, and again, this is kind of where it fits into the big picture of what Schneider's put together to achieve through, you know, up by 2050. But I got to get to 2030 first. And our executives just dropped in, hey, we'd like to make it 2029, not 2030. So just kind of try to scoot that in a little bit and be net zero ready operations. So what is my path to net zero operations? What are my specific steps? Okay, now I'm getting down to actionable items. I need to focus on energy efficiency, which fortunately, because of who we are, we've been doing this for a lot of years and we're actually pretty good at it. Not my team, the facilities team, they do regular energy audits. It's a very big focus. They're continually working on how do we just continue to reduce, you know, our energy that we're using at our operations. Then it's the electrification. And my box got a little bit off of there, but electrification is what we need to do now. So, you know, already working on energy efficiency. So electrification, I don't even know if I'd heard that word. And now we say that word so much, so often. It's kind of funny how much we use that. So that's my, okay, so this is what I need to do is electrification. Okay, what does that mean to me? So in North America, we were like, okay, big task. How do we electrify our operations? What do we do? Where do we start? And I know these seem like some basic things, but you have to step back and you have to go, how am I going to achieve this in all of my 223 sites in North America? I have to have executive sponsorship. I have to have a core team committed to those objectives. We got to figure out the roadmap, the actions that are going to, you know, be required to achieve those objectives. Sorry. So some of it is within our operations. Some of it's process. Some of it's our kitchens. We just talked about kitchens. There's a lot of kitchens that have to be converted. Some of them is, you know, just our regular commercial sites. So how do we get there? And then how do we got to have a scorecard. We've got to assess the impact of our actions. And then this one, this is a big one, you know, except that there is a little return on investment. You know, I've worked in the real estate world for a lot of years, and, you know, you get to do these big fun projects, and I consolidate, and I save a bunch of money, and everybody gets excited because we bring a new site, because we, you know, a smaller footprint. But there's no return on investment. This is something that you have to accept, that there's likely, very likely, not going to be a return on investment, but you still need to make it happen. And then finally, to define the support needed from executive management to be successful. So, and we've been spending, and again, these sound like very basic things, but it's a bigger task than you realize, you know, pulling all this together, kind of defining everything and trying to really make this actionable as an organization. So next, again, drilling down to my team, real estate, exactly what do we need to do? What do I need to do as part of this bigger team? Okay, I got to look at all my sites and say, are they part of the long-term plans? That's important. I don't want to make a big investment into a site that I know I'm going to close in a couple of years. And it really challenges, do I really need all those offices? We've really made an effort to, you know, to close down. Do we really need an office for less than 20 people? With hybrid working, do we really need that? So we've really reduced our footprint, but really also trying to really understand, so first of all, what's in the long-term plan? Then determine which sites are already electrified. Again, sounds kind of funny. Feel like you should know this. We don't. We have a lot of small sites. Hey, do we have gas there? I don't know. Maybe. Who knows? Who pays the bill? How do we find out? We got people out looking around the side of the building. I don't know, Baton Rouge and Geismar. They go, hey, we don't have natural gas. Or, you know, success, check that one off the box. But, you know, it's just been really interesting kind of trying to define and literally talking to landlords and trying to understand, do I have natural gas coming to that building? That's been, again, never thought I'd say electrification so much, never thought I'd ask so much about natural gas, and do you have natural gas coming to your site? So it's just been that, just understanding the scope, what is the actual status, and we will go back and forth on some of these sites. Are you sure? Is there gas? I'm not sure. And, you know, who's paying the bills? How do we find this out? Some areas it's easier than others. To find this out, but that's been a big part of it. And then for the sites and for the areas that are not electrified, are there sites in the market that are electrified? JLL is our broker partner now, so we're sending them out and like, hey, if I'm in a market in Boulder, Colorado, and my site is not electrified, are there sites in the market that are? Answer, in Boulder, Colorado, absolutely, there's quite a few. And a lot of my Canadian sites, not so much. So it's just trying to understand, okay, so I do know a site that I need to target. What else is in the market that is available? And again, I'm finding out some cities that are far ahead of others in terms of thinking ahead and planning for this, but some markets there's not at all. So then it's, what is the cost to electrify? So that is then engaging with and understanding, I got to convert my natural gas to electric. What are the implications of that? How do I make that happen? So that's what the part we're working on right now. And then with all of that information together, complete that plan with a budget and a timeline. So that's kind of the big, how we boiled down and tried to get there. So I'll just finish with the challenges that we're seeing so far. Just a lot of interesting challenges as we, you know, tried to take the right steps through this. You know, landlords that aren't fully on board with sustainability actions. And I kind of like to joke about this. Some of the really large landlords, which I hope they aren't here today, but I won't name them by name. But, you know, I will go to their website and I will see their sustainability commitment. And then I will go and I will say, well, at my specific site in Fairfield, Ohio, I would like to convert the electric HVAC units to natural gas. And they're like, absolutely, on your dime, you can do that, no problems. But when you leave, will you switch those back? And I said, Aren't we talking about the same goals? This seems kind of interesting that you guys, I think we're still a little bit of, we're early in this. Maybe boots on the ground for the landlord, they don't understand it. I was on a tour yesterday in Toronto And we looked up and they had gas heaters. And they said the same thing. They said, yeah, sure, you can switch those out, but put them back when you leave. And I was like, again, we got to be, you know, on the same page here. We're really not. If you guys are, you know, again, they have a lot of big goals, but, you know, understanding what that means in reality and cooperating with us. Limited availability in some markets for electrified options. I mentioned that. Certainly as you go farther north, a lot more comfort heating is natural gas is used for comfort heating. And so we're, you know, certainly coming up with limited options for electrified options in those markets. And then multi-tenant buildings. You know, in Boston, we've got one floor of 34. So how do I possibly electrify just my part? Or if I'm in a mixed-use multi-tenant, but I've just got the end cap, do I just change out my unit? Does that count? That's the struggle, and we have kind of the global governance, and we have to submit a question, and the Boston one has been, I think, one of the most interesting examples, because it's steam heat that comes into that building. So I was like, oh, great, that's steam heat, that's okay. Well, it's steam heat that's generated from natural gas, but it's generated for the city. So I'm like, how do I make a change that, you know, that's driving towards the city? But, and if you look at Boston, they have stated as one of their goals is to become carbon neutral. And I think their goal might be 2050. But how do I get there by 2030 if their goals are a little bit, you know, farther out there? And then finally, the, you know, so electrification, we do this analysis. We say, okay, I got to convert my gas units to electric, but then I'm going to increase my electrical load. So do I have enough service to feed the building to accommodate that? Sometimes not. So then I've got to add service. Well, maybe I'm not just adding service. Maybe I'm adding, and it's at the substation level. And I don't know if you all are, you know, experienced with that now. Adding at a substation level is not an easy thing. It's not a fast thing. You know, our substation lead times in the U.S. right now is like 12 to 18 months. And utilities, they're the ones that are dictating the time. You've got to just listen to what they're telling you. So a lot of great things that we've learned so far. You know, I think there's a lot of great goals that are out there. I'm excited to say electrification now. It's just going to be a lot harder getting there and making it happen. And I think I always consider when you're kind of on the leading edge of some of these goals, though, maybe you're educating. And I feel like I'm educating some of our landlords and our building owners and sometimes even our brokers. They're like, why do you want an electric? What are you talking about? You know, so it's kind of exciting to be that, you know, in that space and trying to kind of lead setting some of those goals. And that is all that I have. And I think Jess is going to come back up. You want us to stay up here?
Yep. Sure. All right. So we're going to start out Q&A today with a few moderated questions, and then we'll open it up to all of you. Okay? So, as Karen, maybe leading off of what you had just said, you know, as you need to kind of pitch electrification, you know, what's the sort of elevator pitch, or what are some ways that you've been finding that's been going well for you?
Well, just doing the right thing is not going well. I tried that. Don't you want to just do the right thing? And I think, again, I was just mentioning it's the education. It's educating, and even for me, as I kind of thought through this myself, it's understanding what the implications are and where do these goals come from? Why are we doing this? You know, why is this? And there's a lot of controversy about electrification and natural gas. And, you know, is the infrastructure, you know, are we able to handle what we're trying to put on here? So it's a big challenge, but it's an education, I would say.
Okay. Do you mind if I actually touch on that subject?
Absolutely.
I know that wasn't originally part of the discussion, but we spend a lot of time talking about electrification. Maybe 40% of my day right now is about electrification. And part of it is because natural gas is a directly controlled emission for mm-hmm. Google. So and for any organization.
Right.
And so we spend a lot of time actually educating our leaders on why electrification is important. And the biggest issue is that it is just so expensive. It is so expensive. Nobody knows how to do it. Trying to estimate the cost, there's like a 150% error bar. And I have a call to the real estate community to help in a way to say, I think there's a huge disconnect between the occupiers and landlords in a lot of situations that you highlighted that is so palpable for us too as an occupier, that we spend quite a bit of time talking about explaining why, what the word electrification means. Because it was like 6 years ago that we took everything that was electric, made it gas, because
gas was...
So I feel like we're in this circular conversation.
Well, we also run into, globally and in other regions, it can be cheaper to electrify. So they are a little bit more successful in other parts of the world. Their factories are a little bit newer. They are able to have a return on investment. And so they look at us in North America and go, what do you mean it's going to cost more? And why are you taking so long? And how does your grid not handle that, you know? So it's very interesting.
Love it.
Awesome. Okay. Feeding off of that a little bit, Karen, you had also talked initially about, you know, going back, trying to get, executive sponsorship and really communicate up those goals. How's it going for both companies as you do need to do those report outs, you know, both the progress of what you've been able to accomplish and what's ahead?
Great question. And it's funny, I see it a couple different ways, and I'm fortunate enough with my leadership and my team, they get it. They get it. But we also have a lot of, affiliate companies that we have part ownership in that they don't. And they say, yep, we have all the same goals as Schneider. And I was like, but you're not doing anything about it. So you can't just say you have those goals. You have to be taking action. And it's back to the education part of it, you know. But I am. I'm fortunate that I've my leadership. They get it. They're on board. They're pushing hard, you know.
So what about Google?
Yeah. So you mentioned something about like reporting progress in that question, and I think that that's a really important element of where we are, and that we made aggressive goals before we knew how we were going to do it. We have a lot of different parts of the organization that contribute. I'll just talk. There's other goals, but I think we're talking a lot about sort of carbon and emissions. But no, there's a lot of other things that we could talk about today, water, et cetera. But the regulatory drivers right now are really focused in the carbon emissions space. That's sort of the urgency. And so we absolutely have sort of organizational buy-in in theory. It's when the theory hits the road that it gets really hard. And so I've actually spent the last year sort of accidentally taking on our ESG reporting because we've had some people move around. Super fun, high recommendations, just for the real estate lens. And it's just unbelievable. Unbelievable how crappy our data can be sometimes, no matter any organization.
Even for Google?
For Google. Stop the recording. And a big part of that is because the world doesn't have great data yet. If we're one floor in a multi-tenant building, how much energy do we use? Well, we use parts of HVAC that everyone shares. And it's really hard to get the information because the utilities sometimes take 2 months to get it to you. And it's just like this shocking situation where it's really hard to report. And then that's one of the hardest pieces when you try to actually communicate that message up to leaders. It's like, well, how are we doing? And it's like, well, you don't know? We know a lot, but we don't know everything yet. So I think the reporting is a place where, in some ways, there's too much focus because a lot of people are reporting and not enough people are focused on doing. But we kind of need that reporting first to help make sure that we're focused in the right areas and tell the story. So it's like a really... It's a balance.
Right. What are your emissions? Well, I'm not sure. But I think maybe, yeah.
Let me give you the 17-page assumptions list.
Awesome. Okay. So, Jess, you had also talked with your global footprint. You mentioned, you know, different regulations, different places. How are you kind of navigating that or helping Google to navigate that?
Yeah, that's a really important element for us because we spend quite a bit of time talking to a lot of the local municipalities for lots of different reasons. And because we have historically done a lot of building, so which means we have to have a lot of partnerships in those regions. What's interesting is we're trying to balance doing everything everywhere with prioritizing the sites where there's regulatory drivers. And so I think the two places to highlight are EMEA everywhere, and we've got a lot of stuff happening there, but also local law 97. So New York is a great example of a regulatory driver where there's a requirement around not just disclosing your energy use, but also around the actual reduction. And so there's regulatory fines that are in place if you are not reducing sort of fast enough and building efficiently enough, and they're significant. And so you're seeing a lot of actual electrification happening in a place like in New York that it would not have happened naturally without those regulatory drivers. But there really is an important conversation around what do we do when, how long is it okay to pay a fine? And those are just, I can't even begin to tell you how palpable those conversations are in real estate right now.
And to add on to that, not just the regulatory piece, but there are some regions where there's government assistance available.
Absolutely.
They are willing to, because I was like, hey, I want to hold off on Quebec. We don't want to do anything yet. They're like, but the government is willing to kick in and pay for half of the evaluation. So that's kind of a driver as well. There's you know, they're willing to assist. But understanding all that in all those regions is complex as well.
Yeah, lots of carrots and sticks, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah.
Awesome. Okay, final question from me, and then we'll open it up. For both of you, what challenges have you seen, or what advice would you give to others as they do this from the end user perspective?
You want to start?
Me?
Go ahead. There's so many. Where do I start? I think the landlord piece is really important for real estate, that connectivity between the two. There's like this really interesting mismatch between goals from different organizations and how we, like, the rubber hits the road. I think that's one of the things. I also think there's just a moment right now where there's a lot of fear around like general market movement. And so I think most organizations are 3 or 4 years ago were investing a lot in ESG and carbon efficiency in general, emissions reduction in general. And I think that it's just there's a moment now where there's a lot of organizations that had 2030 and 2040 goals, and we're now like close to 2030, and everyone's sort of freaking out a little bit right now. So I think that's a challenge, is that it's really expensive and it doesn't have an ROI, and there's not necessarily the business case to do a lot of this work without the regulatory drivers, even though we sort of hate regulatory drivers sometimes. And so I'm not sure there's really advice other than to stay attuned to it as you can, be knowledgeable about it, hear about it. And for people who are not in the sustainability space, listen. So when a sustainability person, I think, sometimes comes up a little bit alarmist because we're like scared of some things that are coming up, some things are really coming up.
Yeah, really.
My advice.
Yeah. I'm taking a bite out of the elephant. It's, you know, one bite at a time. It seems big and overwhelming. But you got to drill it down and put it into actionable, very actionable steps.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. George and I are going to walk around with the mics, so please wait until we get to you. But any questions from the audience?
Thanks. Hi, I'm Beth Forstnager. I'm with CBRE. I appreciated your presentations. And the two things that caught my attention were the carbon-free energy 2030, and the sustainable development goals from the UN 2030 as well. And this is a big picture question and a little bit selfish because I'm working with Cornet. CBRE is leading a team to predict 2030 for ESG. So I would be curious to hear from two experts. When you think about 2030, what from either value, accountability, standardization, anything you can tell me about what you think this looks like in 6 years?
Go ahead. Oh, thanks. This might be a little bit, I don't know the right word for it, but this is not a quote necessarily, but something that I've been hearing quite a bit more at some conferences. I think there was originally a really big interest in measuring all of carbon, which I'll call scopes 1, 2, and 3. Scopes 1 is what you burn on site. That's natural gas. 2 is your purchased electricity. And 3 is like everything you buy. It's your value chain. And I think there's going to be an even stronger focus on an organization's scope 1 and scope 2 because three is really hard to measure. And I think the world is figuring out how hard that is to draw lines between. And if everybody just sort of sorted out their own one and two, we wouldn't have to worry about three. So a little bit provocatively, I think we've been seeing, I think, hints that number, like that original focus on the actual operations as Schneider really spends time focusing on, I think will continue to be a much bigger driver. But I think even if it's not called ESG, it's not going away.
I think in terms of meeting 2030 goals, it's rapidly approaching, right? This sounded so far away. I think when they set those goals in 2015, it's like, you know, turning course on a big ship. I just think there's a lot of things that probably won't happen. I think we'll start to see the beginning of it. I think things will start to shift, and I think we'll start to see that. But I hope I meet my own goals. But everybody else coming on board, I think, is going to be a very slow change. And I think, as we've been talking about, it's going to take regulatory requirements to really make a shift. I mean, you know, we're a European company. I think a lot of North American-based companies are a little bit farther behind. And I knew that when we went to, we were ahead on the energy efficiency, and I learned a lot of big American manufacturers that seemed not so concerned about it. So it just takes a little bit longer to kind of bring everybody on board that doesn't have more of a global view.
Yeah. Anyone else? No more questions? Really? You're all that excited to get to your next meeting?
We won't bite, I promise.
Question. So with hybrid policies and remote workers, do your goals only relate to people coming into a workplace and your corporate real estate, or do you factor in when you have people that work in sometimes from home? I know it's not as much of an impact, but you talked about food. So like there'd be food waste at home if you were there eating your meals. Does that come into play, or is it just the workplace that you're focused on?
I'm really glad you asked that question. So that actually aligns directly to the comment that I just made about your third, your like value chain and how hard it is to figure out what you include and not include. We have teleworking, we have an impact on teleworking. So we do estimate how much every Googler uses energy at home. Again, a lot of estimation involved in that. And we also estimate the transportation to and from the office, but we do not include what a Googler is eating at home on their non-work days. And that's in the environmental report. That's like public, so you can look that up. I'm not spilling beans. But it's really hard. Like, where do you draw the line, right? This is like a constant conversation about efficiency and the impact, because it does make a difference in something like your hybrid policy. So it's complicated.
And I think we encourage a lot of the behaviors. It's kind of one of those we try to lead by example and try to encourage employees to be doing, you know, I don't want to say the right thing, but, you know, changing their sustainability habits at home and encouraging the discussions about it, but not measuring or forcing. You know, that's what you're doing, but we also know you have an impact on the planet, but we're going to let you kind of try to do the right thing, like the landlords. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. So, Justice goes to you. You had something up in the upper right-hand corner of one of your slides that said, like, 350 million, 350,000 bonds. So my question is, was that based on, if you have a building and you have panels on the roof and you're bringing in solar energy and you don't need all of that, are you issuing that back to others, so that way, do you get the credit or do they get the credit?
That's a totally different thing.
Cool. You can do both of those then.
Yeah. So, without getting too technical and everybody falls asleep. So there's two different. So our sustainability bond was really around basically funding a lot of sustainability initiatives. That's just like a funding mechanism essentially that we issued. So like we basically allow people to like invest on our behalf to do a bunch of sustainability things. That is a separate conversation from what we call our renewable. So if you do a project or like buy, if you do a, what's called a PPA, it's a power purchase agreement, and you want to buy a solar, right? But I'm not going to do it on my actual site. So I own property, but I'm going to do it on another site. It's like another location. we basically like develop our own solar project. And we enter in something called a power purchase agreement, which like for all intents and purposes is a little bit like leasing. And essentially what you get when you do a solar project or any alternative energy project is both the actual energy itself and what's called a REC, which is like the thing that proves that it's sustainable. And both things you can buy. You can buy the energy and you can buy the renewable energy credit. And so it's the combination of the two that like makes something alternative and like green energy. And so we spend quite a bit of time working on that engagement, that REC engagement, to make sure that we have like the connectivity for all of our alternative energy purchasing. But that's separate from the sustainability fund that we issued sort of more publicly. I think everyone's asleep, I'm sorry. Yep. It's really hard to answer some questions without being too technical.
Awesome, any last questions? All right. Well, thank you so much to Jess and Karen. Thanks, everyone, for coming today.